Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for November 10th, 2024, the cover story, The Climate Generation. It haunted their childhood, has upended their adolescence, and will define the rest of their lives. And then, from the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine, more than gastritis. And following that, we still should have time for the interview section with Peter Singer. But first, The Climate Generation. This article was written by Charlie Locke. A 12-year-old activist from Canada became the girl who silenced the world for 5 minutes. As diplomats and scientists looked on at the landmark climate conference, Severn Cullis Suzuki asked whether any parents could tell their kids they were doing the best they could or deny the hypocrisy and lessons of solidarity and kindness that they try to offer at bedtime. "I'm only a child and I don't have all the solutions," Cullis Suzuki told the audience. "I want you to realize neither do you," she added. "If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it." This was more than a decade before Greta Thunberg was even born. It was more than 25 years before she traveled from her home in Sweden to Davos, Switzerland, and as a 16-year-old told the world's assembled elites, "Our house is on fire." She then proceeded to excoriate them in language that helped ignite a global climate awakening. "Adults keep saying, we owe it to the young people to give them hope. But I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then, I want you to act." In the years since Thunberg's speech, as teenagers organized hundreds of climate strikes around the world and pressured world leaders to acknowledge the crisis of warming and marshal vast resources to address it, we have set one new emissions record after another. Indeed, between those two warnings in 1992 and 2019, humans generated roughly as much carbon emissions as had previously been produced, in total, across the full span of human civilization. Almost a decade after the Paris Climate Agreement pledged to limit temperatures rise, carbon concentrations are now growing at unprecedented rates. And the rate of warming, which has stunned and befuddled the world's top scientists, has accelerated too. By some measures, there has been great progress. Net zero pledges, major investments, electric vehicles everywhere, and a solar boom. By others, like total emissions and temperature rise, things are clearly heading in the wrong direction. In the years after the Paris Agreement, scientists outlined the importance of limiting warming to below 2 degrees Celsius and the projected consequences of breaching that threshold produced a global spasm of climate alarm. Now, what just a few years ago looked like a grim climate future appears to be a practical inevitability. And yet we are not living through a cresting wave of warming panic. Instead, the climate hysteria of 2019 has given way over 5 years of pandemic and war and worries over inflation and artificial intelligence to what is more like a background hum of anxiety, softened here and there with notes of upbeat techno-optimism and promises of future action. The world's young people know better, as the interviews by Charlie Locke over the following pages illustrate. The testimonials are not primarily those of teenage activists from whom we have recently heard so much. They are simply the observations of young people living with their eyes open on the front lines of warming in some of the most climate-battered parts of the world: Bangladesh, Tanzania, the wildfire-gutted region of Alberta, Canada, Not all of them have been hit by what we now casually call climate disasters, but the drift of change is no less obvious in those places that have avoided catastrophe thus far, particularly for those young enough to imagine futures of their own many decades long. But one does not even have to imagine especially long lives. By the time today's teenagers are 45, around the age Cullis Suzuki is now, the world is likely to have passed the 2 degrees Celsius warming threshold which the Paris Agreement promised we would avoid. At that level of warming, the type of deadly flooding that recently hit Central Africa would be expected nearly every year. The lethal heat that killed 1,300 during this spring's Hajj pilgrimage would be 13 times as likely as today. Increasingly, scientists worry not just about these projectable risks, but about nonlinear ones as well. Tipping point dynamics that could push critical systems and ecosystems, like the Amazon rainforest or some ocean circulation patterns, irreversibly into unrecognizable states. According to one prominent research group, the world is already outside the safe operating space for 6 of 9 of those planetary boundaries and moving further outside it day by day. This is all quite alarming to those contemplating the facts and the shape of the future for the first time. But in the rich world, teenagers giving voice to climate worries, or to rage, or to grief, or to policy demands, are sometimes mocked for their naivete and told to check their privilege. And yet, lamentations and calls to action sound different when the stage isn't global, as it is at Davos or the United Nations. For teenagers farther from real power and speaking out nevertheless, unintimidated by the distance, moral clarity isn't privilege. Fatalism is. And I should mention that this introduction was written by David Wallace Wells. The following stories of young people around the world were written by Charlie Locke, as previously mentioned. When Fire Stalks Your Childhood. Lucy Curry, 14, Jasper, Alberta. In June, after much negotiating with their parents, Lucy Curry and 3 of her friends went solo camping for the first time. Growing up in Jasper, Alberta, at the edge of a vast national park, Curry has explored the backcountry since she was a little kid, but never without adults. The group set up their tent, roasted hot dogs, and played card games late into the night, while one friend's dad camped nearby just in case. It was so much fun, Curry says. A few weeks later, wildfires swept through Jasper National Park, burning over 81,000 acres and ravaging the town of Jasper. Curry found out about the evacuation order while she and her family were on a week-long vacation. Soon after, she learned that the fire had consumed her home and her grandparents' house next door. "I was in shock," she says. Normally an overpacker, Curry had been proud to bring just one backpack and one stuffed animal. Now everything else she owned was gone. "It sounds kind of dumb, but I was just sad about what I had collected on my walls," she says. "I had so many pictures, like Polaroids of me and my friends, and random cutouts from magazines." Curry is back at school now, although with about a third of the town's buildings destroyed, life doesn't feel back to normal. Her family is living in a rental that's half an hour outside town, which means she has to ask for a ride anytime she wants to meet up with friends. "I have to plan everything ahead," she says. Curry is still grappling with what she lost, including her ability to turn away from climate change. "I've always heard of other towns being affected," she says, "but it was just a passing thought." By the 2050s, the abnormally hot and dry weather conditions that led to recent record fire seasons in Canada are likely to become common, which could lead to larger and more frequent wildfires. Curry will be in her 40s. When it's hard to buy rice. Obama Mchembe, 15, Toangoma, Tanzania. Obama Mchembe pays attention to rain. He has to. When the roads flood, he stays home from school for days at a time. Floods, heat, and drought make it harder to grow crops, so his family struggles to buy staple foods, including maize flour, rice, and sugar. In the past, it was normal for us to eat foods like rice, Mchembe says, but now, for a month, we can eat rice once or twice. Mchembe worries about what climate change means for the future, both for himself and for his country. He worries about Tanzania's economy, too. If the glaciers at Mount Kilimanjaro melt, as they are predicted to do by 2050, will the tourists stop coming? Poverty exacerbates the effects of climate change and vice versa, and Mchembe recognizes how unfair that is. He sees how people around him have to prioritize survival over climate change. Still, he believes that every person bears a responsibility. He and his classmates have started planting cassia trees in a field beside their school, where the dense foliage will provide shade and absorb carbon dioxide. Mchembe knows that he can't do anything about the past. I don't think it's possible to return the price of food to how it was or to reform the glaciers at Mount Kilimanjaro, he says. But the simple act of planting trees makes all of us feel courage. By 2050, Tanzania may experience significant drought and more intense flooding, which could lead to a widespread decrease in agriculture and a lowering of the gross domestic product by up to 18%. Mchembe will be 41. When going outside makes you sick. Aisha Ali, 16, Dhaka, Bangladesh. Next year, Aisha Ali will take an exam to determine where she can go to college. The competition is intense, and Ali wants to become a surgeon, so she knows she has to prepare. But it's extremely difficult for her to focus. The heat and air pollution give me a headache a lot of the time, she says. In some parts of Dhaka, breathing the air is the equivalent of smoking 1.6 cigarettes a day. But it's not just the pollution. Climate change affects our country in every way, Ali says. UNICEF estimates that 4 million people live in slums in Dhaka, many of whom fled floods and eroding riverbanks elsewhere in Bangladesh. Unpredictable rains flood the roads and create health hazards. Ali's skin often breaks out into painful rashes and pimples, and despite her efforts to keep her long hair healthy, it has started to fall out in clumps. She suspects that it has to do with the air pollution. Going outside is an ordeal. Traveling exhausts me a lot, Ali says. She leaves her apartment to go to tutoring centers where she studies, but otherwise stays home, watching TV or reading fantasy novels, with the fan on and the blinds closed. Ali remembers a time before the weather made her feel so bad, when she and her friends would meet up in an open field by her grandmother's house, a space now covered by buildings. In the winter months, sometimes they can still meet up outside, but the city is so overcrowded that there's not really anywhere to go. When she does see her friends, they often talk about their physical ailments, headaches, insomnia, acne. Climate change has become the lens through which they see their days. Confronted with the cascading impacts of warming, floods, erosion, overcrowding, desperation, crime, Ali feels overwhelmed, as if she has no choice but to leave her country. It feels like I was born in the wrong generation, she says. By 2050, more than 13 million Bangladeshis could become internal migrants because of climate effects. Ali will be 42. When glaciers disappear before your eyes. Daniela Bazan, 16, Huaraz, Peru. Daniela Bazan has recently started to feel a strange kind of disappointment, a longing for a version of her home that she never got to experience. In Huaraz, she can see the glacier-covered mountains of the Cordillera Blanca, the Huascarón, the Huandoy. Early in the morning, it's so beautiful when it first lights up, she says. I imagine it would have looked so beautiful before. Bazan feels as if she's coming of age during an awful in-between. Too late to save the physical landscapes she loves, but just in time to watch their destruction. For hers and other communities in the Andes, the melting of the glaciers is a practical catastrophe, especially alongside drought. The snowy mountains provide water for millions of people and for agriculture. They also foster a tourist economy. The drought affects farms, and since our families are still working in them, they've lost a lot, Bazan says. Her grandparents now struggle to grow crops like purple and white corn, threatening their livelihood. Bazan's parents tell her about a time when they could go to a nearby river and catch enough fish for a meal. Now the river is empty, Bazan says. She fears what it could be like to lose the blooming yellow flowers, orchids, and black cherries. The transformation makes traditional ways of life harder, which pushes increasing numbers of young people to leave their communities in the Andes for better opportunities in Peruvian cities. In a heritage closely tied to the physical landscape, shrinking glaciers are also a spiritual loss. Bazan's father and grandfather make offerings to the Apus, the mountain gods. Here, landscapes are valued not only for their beauty, Bazan says, but also for their stories. By the 2050s, up to 98% of the glaciers in the central Peruvian Andes could disappear. Bazan will be in her 40s. When you feel like one of the lucky ones. Irioluwa Ajayi, 16, Oda, Nigeria. Oda, where Irioluwa Ajayi lives, is a market town an hour's drive north of Lagos. In recent years, the region has experienced extreme heat and heavy rainfall. Around Nigeria, floods contaminate drinking water and create breeding grounds for malaria-carrying mosquitoes. The high temperatures can lead to heat stroke and rashes. Ajayi emphasizes how lucky he feels. His family has fans that they use at night during heat waves, which are powered by a mini solar panel. They have a water purifier to use when water sources become contaminated. They used to live in an area of Lagos State where the flooding was much worse. They were able to move to safer ground while many others were not. I think about the people that don't have a way to leave, especially children, he says. When the weather is so bad, I'll be thinking of how they do without food and without water. But Ajayi, for all his concern about others, is hardly unscathed himself. For a while he got heat rashes, which sometimes grew so painful that he wound up hospitalized. When it floods, the roads get so bad that Ajayi has to take off his shoes and walk in the water to get home from school. Other days, flooding forces his school to close and makes seeing friends impossible, leaving him isolated. I don't get to play outside or hang out with my friends because there'll be water everywhere, he says. Instead, he stays home and draws. Ajayi believes that once people connect the dots on the effects of climate change, they'll start to take action. I feel like a lot of people are not taught about climate, he says, and that's why they keep burning up fossil fuels. By 2080, the number of heat-related deaths in Nigeria could increase fourfold. Ajayi will be 72. When you realize the burdens on you. Athanasios Kostias, 16, Kalamata, Greece. Lately, Athanasios Kostias has been feeling angry more often. He attributes it to the heat. In September, the temperature regularly rose to 90 degrees or higher. Without any fans or air conditioning at school, Kostias found it nearly impossible to concentrate. The heat gets to him even more at his family's restaurant, where he delivers hot plates of eggplant souvlaki to customers. When it's hot, I feel dizzy and I get angrier and angrier, and I don't want to work anymore, he says. I don't want to talk to anyone, but it's not possible because I'm the waiter. In the past year, Greece has experienced both the hottest winter and the hottest summer on record. In July, after being chosen to participate in Greece's youth parliament, Kostias had the chance to ask the country's education minister about the poor condition of their schools and the effects of climate change. At first, I felt happy because I got the opportunity to talk to someone who is responsible for everything, Kostias says. Yet later, I realized that he wasn't answering my questions. Though answers from the politicians he spoke with sounded good, they were platitudes. I felt like they were doing chores, he says, like they had been told to listen to some young people talking. If the existing leaders can't or won't create change, he reasons, then that burden will fall to him and his peers. We are the ones that are responsible for climate change, he says, not politicians. By 2050, parts of Greece may experience 15 to 20 more days per year of extreme heat, reaching over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Kostias will be 42. When your motherland is being swallowed by the ocean. Sarah Somanaia, 15, Christchurch, New Zealand, and Tuvalu. When Sarah Somanaia thinks about climate change, she thinks about both of her homes. She sees New Zealand, where she has lived her entire life, as her homeland, and she sees Tuvalu, where her family is from, as her motherland. It's hard to see one country doing so well, she says, and one country struggling. Somanaia and her family live on the east side of Christchurch, a predominantly working-class neighborhood of Maori and Pacific Islander immigrants. The area is especially vulnerable to the effects of climate change. After a heavy rain, the streets around Somanaia's home regularly flooded. Once during a lesson on climate change, Somanaia's science teacher asked if anyone in the class was from Tuvalu. Everyone looked at Somanaia, the only Tuvaluan in her grade. The teacher explained that the island might soon be subsumed by rising sea levels. Students oohed as if she were in trouble. Some classmates laughed. I'm a really confident, brave, strong person, and I know what I stand for, Somanaia says. But there's also my family back home, who I pray for every day. They're just struggling, and here they are mocking them because their island is about to be gone. She wants to change the perception of Tuvaluans and those from other small Pacific islands, and she wants to foster pride among the next generation of Tuvaluans, too. She practices the fetel, or traditional Tuvalu dance, and the Tuvaluan language in part so she can pass it on to her future children. Even if our country does end up going away, she says, that doesn't make our culture and who we are as people go away. By 2050, it's estimated that half the land area of Funafuti, the main atoll of Tuvalu, will become flooded by tidal waters. Somanaia will be 41. Charlie Locke, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, primarily covering what it's like to grow up and to grow old. And now from the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine, her stomach pain was unbearable. What was causing it? The terrible pain started a week earlier, and she had already been to the emergency room twice. This article was written by Lisa Sanders, M.D. You need to go back to the hospital, the visiting nurse declared shortly after entering the 68-year-old woman's bedroom. The patient's hair was matted, her face pale and dotted with sweat. She moaned softly as she shifted in the bed, the tangled sheets a testament to her search for a comfortable position. The woman knew the nurse was right. The terrible pain in her gut started a week earlier, and she had already been to the emergency room twice, even though the pandemic had recently invaded her suburban Long Island town. She had to go back. Something was horribly wrong with her. On her first visit, the ER was crowded with people in masks. When she was finally examined, the doctor offered reassurance and sent her home with the recommendation to follow up with her gastrointestinal doctor. But she couldn't follow up with anyone. She could barely get out of bed. She called her son in California and begged him to come help his father take care of her. Before her son could get there, she was back in the ER. This time she was admitted. Her blood tests and CT scan were normal, but an endoscopy suggested that she had gastritis, an inflammation of the stomach lining. She was prescribed a strong antacid, a medication to coat her stomach, and another to increase her gastrointestinal motility. The woman was dubious. She'd had gastritis before. That pain was different and certainly not this severe. Her son arrived the day she was discharged from that hospital stay. He was shocked when he saw his mother being wheeled out. She was so thin, so pale, and so very weak. It took both him and his father to support her into the car, then into the house. The medications didn't help. The woman spent 4 days at home in bed in pain. She couldn't eat and could barely drink. And then the nurse came and sent her back to the ER a third time. This time her husband drove her to a different hospital. She knew she looked a mess, hair unbrushed, face unwashed, still in her pajamas. But she was beyond caring. The 10-minute drive to NYU Langone Hospital, Long Island in Mineola, was agony. Every little bump knifed through her gut. Her husband helped her into triage, and she was seen almost immediately. A young woman, a physician assistant, was in charge of her care in the ER. She listened as the patient described the stabbing pain that never left and got so much worse when she moved or ate. She'd vomited a little, had some diarrhea, and her legs were weak. The PA examined the patient gently. The woman groaned when she felt the stethoscope press into her belly. They took her blood and her urine. She was given medication for the pain. This time the test results were abnormal. Her white blood cell count was elevated, which could indicate infection but could also be caused by the stress of her illness. The normal chemicals in her blood were out of whack, probably because she hadn't been eating. But it was the CT scan of her abdomen that made the PA and then the ER doctors reluctant to send her home. For years, the woman had suffered with extensive osteoarthritis in her joints, and doctors had recently implanted a spinal cord stimulator in her abdomen to help manage those aches. The stimulator and battery were visible on the CT scan, their metal casings radiating white amid the gray of the images, obscuring the surrounding tissues. But instead of dampening her chronic pain, the device caused a burning, buzzing pain bad enough that she turned it off. Could that device somehow be the cause of her symptoms? But there was something else. The radiologist noted that one part of the blood vessel taking oxygenated blood from the aorta to the intestines, the mesenteric artery, looked strange. The walls were thicker than normal, and the interior wall was lumpy and narrowed. Was this atherosclerotic disease, the so-called hardening of the arteries, where plaques of fat and cholesterol build up inside blood vessel walls? She was in her late 60s, after all. The neurosurgical PA who came to assess the spinal cord stimulator was dismissive. The hardware was tucked between the skin and the muscle wall, not inside the abdominal cavity where the pain was. That PA was followed by a stream of doctors. The general surgery team came by, pressed on her belly, and moved on, unimpressed. The vascular surgeon arrived to tell her she needed medication and not an operation. The internal medicine team visited briefly to let her know they would be coordinating her care. It wasn't until the following morning that the patient met a doctor who stayed to ask questions and provide some answers. Dr. David Yike was the rheumatology fellow and had been asked to see her because of the possibility her symptoms were signs of an autoimmune disease. Yike asked to hear her story and then examined her carefully. Her legs were weak and moving them was quite painful. The rheumatologist suspected that had more to do with her osteoarthritis than this new issue, but he had to make sure. Blood tests showed that the woman's markers of inflammation were high. Given that and the strange appearance of her blood vessels on the CT scan, it seemed she might have another less common cause of thickening and irregularities in the vessel walls, vasculitis, and inflammation of the arteries. Vasculitis would explain her belly pain. Eating and drinking required increased blood flow to the digestive tract, and the narrowed inflamed vessels caused by vasculitis would reduce that flow, resulting in pain and damage to the intestinal walls. Yike checked for rashes and tender bruise-like nodules on her legs, often seen in one of the deadliest forms of vasculitis, called polyarteritis nodosa. There weren't any, but other forms of the condition could be more subtle, and Yike still suspected that the patient had vasculitis. His job, he explained to her, was to look for the cause of the inflammation and see if any other vessels were involved. They would have to get imaging of her brain, neck, and chest, and they would check her blood for signs of autoimmune diseases known to cause mesenteric vasculitis. No matter the cause, vasculitis is a dangerous disease and, if untreated, often fatal. The usual treatment was high-dose steroids, but the patient had osteoporosis, a thinning of the bones that could cause devastating fractures, and high doses of these medicines can cause bone loss over time, so Yike had to be certain that steroids were worth the risk. The follow-up scans showed terrible arthritis, most likely explaining the weakness in her legs. There were no areas of vascular inflammation beyond the one in her mesenteric artery, and the blood tests looking for other causes of vasculitis were unrevealing. This was unusual, but Yike figured that vasculitis was still the most likely cause of the woman's pain, but they would only know for sure if her pain disappeared after the first couple of doses of steroids. And so, on the third day of her third hospital visit, the patient was started on intravenous high-dose steroids. Almost immediately, her appetite came back. More important, she could eat without the terrible spasms of pain that had been a constant companion for nearly 2 weeks. Once she was able to eat, she was eager to go home. But once she was home, the pain and weakness in her legs persisted. Additional testing confirmed that she had severe osteoarthritis in her hips, and a few months later, hip replacement surgery helped with that pain. Despite the extensive testing, the cause of her vasculitis was never identified. The high doses of steroids were slowly lowered over the next 9 months. She was warned that the vasculitis could come back, that it often did. But that was 4 years ago, and she has had no hint of recurrence. She still has lots of aches and pains, of course. Her osteoarthritis continues to make her active life a symphony of discomfort at times. But the memory of that terrible belly pain helps her keep those old familiar aches in perspective. Lisa Sanders, MD, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her latest book is Diagnosis: Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. If you have a solved case to share, write to her at lisa.sandersmdnyt@gmail.com. I would now like to just take a moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now from the interview section of the New York Times Magazine, Peter Singer wants to shatter your moral complacency. This interview was conducted by David Marchese. I believe that most of us, in our own humble ways, try to make the world better. Maybe that means giving what we can to charity or helping out in our community. Maybe it means eating less meat or driving less often. It's enough for each of us to do our own little part. Not so, says Peter Singer. Singer, who is 78 and recently retired from a long teaching career at Princeton, is perhaps the world's most influential living philosopher. His unstinting work grows out of utilitarianism, which is the view that we should do as much as possible to bring about the greatest circumstance for every individual being, and being does not necessarily mean human. His 1975 book, Animal Liberation, A Broadside Against Factory Farming and a Defense of Animal Rights, helped galvanize a movement toward vegan and vegetarian eating. Singer's new book, Consider the Turkey, is a polemic against the enormous animal suffering that goes into the traditional Thanksgiving turkey feast. And his writing on what the relatively affluent owe to the poor, short version, A Lot More, was an important building block for the data-driven philanthropic movement known as effective altruism, which became popular with high-profile Silicon Valley figures, including the disgraced cryptocurrency magnate Sam Bankman-Fried, as well as plenty of regular people looking to do more good, more efficiently. But Singer is as controversial as he is influential. Not so much for his attempts to disrupt complacent common-sense ethical beliefs that, for example, were justified in prioritizing the welfare of those close to us over that of strangers far away, but more for his arguments in support of things like allowing parents to pursue euthanasia for severely disabled infants. It's those ideas that have led Singer to being called dangerous, a eugenicist, and worse. None of which seems to matter much to Singer, who, as always, is determined to follow his ethical ideas wherever they may lead. And now the interview. I promise I don't mean this in a facetious way. Why did you write Consider the Turkey? It's a small book. There aren't really new arguments in it. Could that time have been better spent doing something else? This is an important issue. We're talking about over 200 million turkeys who are reared in a way that comes close to being described as torture. It hurts them to stand up because their immature leg bones don't bear the immense weight that they've been bred to put on in a short time. They suffer at slaughter and, as I describe in the book, if they get bird flu, the entire shed is killed by heat stroke quite commonly. It's not the only method used in the United States, but it's used on millions of birds. The ventilation is stopped in the shed, heaters are brought in, and they are deliberately heated to death over a period of hours. That's something that Americans don't know, and it's important they should know, because it should stop. I think that's definitely worth the time it took to write this book. It feels hard to deny the unacceptable level of suffering that goes into our Thanksgiving turkey dinners, but millions of people are still going to have them. Do you ever feel as if you're banging your head against the wall with this stuff? No. I feel like I'm banging my head against something which is pretty hard, but not completely unyielding. In some parts of the world, we've made progress in the laws and regulations concerning animals. On the whole, yes, things are still bad. But it's possible to make progress, and we have to keep bringing these facts in front of the public and getting them to think about what they're eating. The Thanksgiving meal seems like a good place to start. There's a journalistic trope of how to talk to your ideologically opposed relative at Thanksgiving. So if someone reads your book and thinks, well, now I have something to say about eating this turkey at Thanksgiving, what guidance can you give them about how to start that conversation? Be civil and reasonable. Say, have a look at some of these facts and, do you really want to be complicit in these practices? If somebody doesn't accept the argument or insists this is irrelevant, or they're not going to listen, at some point you might say, If you want me at your Thanksgiving, I don't want to be there with a big bird sitting on the table who has suffered in the ways the standard American Thanksgiving turkey has suffered. You would suggest drawing that hard line? Yes, at some point you want to say, and isn't that true of important moral issues? Sorry, I just can't go along with that. I think of you as being best known for your work on animals and ethics, which flows out of utilitarian principles, that the right action is the one that produces the most good. But you're also seen as one of the godfathers of effective altruism. Can you explain what effective altruism is and how it builds on utilitarianism? Sure. Effective altruism is the view that, firstly, we ought to try to make the world a better place. Doesn't mean that we all have to become saints, but it should be an important goal for people to think, what can I do to make the world better? And to think about that in a global way, not just for me and my family and those close to me, but for people anywhere in the world and, indeed, for beings capable of suffering who are not of our species. Effective altruism developed into a kind of social movement to encourage people to do that, and effective altruists have done a lot of research to try to find which are the most effective charities in different areas. What is the connection with utilitarianism? I think if you are a utilitarian, you ought to be an effective altruist, because if you're a utilitarian, you ought to want to reduce suffering and increase happiness. And given that we all have limited resources, surely we should be using those resources as effectively as possible to do as much good as we can. An offshoot of effective altruism is long-termism, which is basically the idea that we have as much ethical responsibility to address threats to humanity far off in the future as we do threats in the present. I'm curious what you make of that. I accept the idea that when suffering occurs is not affected by time. If I could be certain that something I did now would do more to reduce suffering in 100 or even 1,000 years than anything I could do to relieve suffering in the present, then sure, I would think that would be the right thing to do. But we don't have that certainty about the future. That's a big barrier to make it a real priority to think about the future as more important than the present. The other question that needs to be raised is a deep philosophical question about the risk of extinction of our species. That's what a lot of long-termists are focused on. They're saying, if our species gets through the next century or two, then it's likely that humans will be around not just for thousands, but for millions of years, because by then we'll be able to colonize other planets. If we become extinct, none of that will happen, so we must give a very high priority to reducing the risk of extinction of our species. And that raises the question of, is it as bad that beings do not come into existence and therefore do not have happy lives, as it is that an already existing being who could have a happy life is prevented from having a happy life? What's the answer? I think it's still an open question. It would be a tragic loss if our species became extinct, but how do we compare that tragedy with tragedies that might occur now to a billion people? I can't give a good answer to that. I think it could be reasonable to say, no, we should focus on the present, where we're going to have greater confidence in what we're doing, than focus on the long-term distant future. I'm just a ding-dong, but it seems that there are common-sense objections to long-termism. It's like, if I see a fire in my yard that I could put out and save some people, shouldn't I obviously do that rather than say, well, I'm working on a fire-retardant system that could save millions of lives at some undefined point in the future? It runs into what appears to be a common-sense problem, because our intuitions obviously are to help the people now. We've evolved to deal with problems that are right there and now. Our ancestors survived because they dealt with those problems. They didn't survive because they had strong intuitions that we ought to act for the distant future, because there was nothing they could do about the distant future. We are now in a position where we have more influence on whether there will be a human future, so I'm inclined not to trust those common sense intuitions. But my answer would be, sure, you should put out the fire, not because that's just your common sense intuition, but because you can be highly confident that you can do a lot of good there. And anyway, you can put out the fire and go back to your work on the fire retardant tomorrow. Not trusting common sense intuition is sort of Peter Singer's whole bag. I think that's right. Don't trust your intuitions to think that you ought to help your neighbors in your affluent community rather than distant people elsewhere in the world that you can't relate to. Don't trust your intuitions in thinking that it's only humans that matter or human suffering that is always a higher priority than non-human animal suffering. I'm somewhat skeptical about trusting those moral intuitions. You take these moral intuitions about things that people hold closely, like what we eat or how we spend our money, or even the notion that we're good, and you say, hold on a second, are you really behaving ethically? Where do you think your impulse to do that comes from? It came gradually. I started thinking about particular issues where it was obvious that you could reduce suffering, but people had intuitive reasons for not doing so. One of those was the area of biomedical ethics. I was interested in issues about death and dying, and I've for a long time been a supporter of medical assistance in dying. When I started talking to people about that, especially doctors, they would say, look, it's all right for us to allow people who are suffering to die by not treating them, but we can't cross that line and actually assist them in dying. And I would say, well, why? That example is one where I was critical of intuitions. They were perhaps religiously based intuitions. The fact that I wasn't religious may have led me to challenge those intuitions. But then I started thinking about a whole range of other intuitions that were probably not religious but maybe based in what helped our ancestors to survive. I was reading the academic journal that you co-edit, the Journal of Controversial Ideas. The idea behind the journal is to give rigorous academic treatment and platform to ideas that might be seen as beyond the pale. There are plenty of what seem to me to be relevant arguments in the journal to do with things like public health and academia, and then there are pieces about when blackface should be allowed or arguing for zoophilia, bestiality. Who's clamoring for deeper arguments in support of these things? What is the point other than provocation? I think both those issues, although they're certainly far less significant than many of the issues that articles in the journal discuss, have some significance. The question about blackface is relevant to drawing lines about what are people going to be criticized for. The article takes a nuanced approach to that. It acknowledges that there would be cases in which using blackface would be offensive and inappropriate, but it also refers to other cases in which it's not objectionable. So if people are going to be outed in some way for doing this, and it happened to Justin Trudeau, then you do need to say, what are the cases in which this is not such a bad thing to do? And the case of zoophilia? Yeah, tell me that one. Well, people go to jail for this, and they may not be causing any harm. It's reasonable if somebody's going to be sent to prison to ask, have you harmed any sentient being? Should this be a crime? Why should it be a crime? Now there's maybe a very small number of cases that would get prosecuted, but I think that's enough justification for airing the issue. People have criticized you for not taking into account aspects of personal experience about which you might be ignorant. The example I'm thinking of is your idea that parents should have the right to terminate babies born with severe disabilities that might cause them to suffer terribly. Critics say that you can't wrap your head around the fact that lives very different from your own might be just as valuable or involve as much happiness, and that some of your ideas also might be stigmatizing or objectifying to non-normative bodies. Is there anything to the criticism that rationally theorizing from a distance is missing something essential? Rationally theorizing from a distance easily can miss something essential, certainly, but I don't think that applies to my views about these cases. I formed those views after having discussions not only with doctors in charge of treating infants born with severe disabilities, but also some of the parents of those infants, of those children who were no longer infants. I had discussed this with a number of people, both in person and in letters that I had from people. I remember one who said, "The doctors got to play with their toys, meaning their surgical equipment and their skills, at helping my son to survive, and then they handed the baby over to us, and the result has been that my child has suffered for 9 years." I do find it strange that some people in the disability movement who are mentally as gifted as anyone but happen to be in wheelchairs think that the fact that they are in a wheelchair gives them greater insight into what it's like to be a child with severe disabilities that are not just physical but also mental, or what it's like to be the parents of children like that. I don't know what they're saying that it gives them particular insights into that specific example. I think they're saying they might have specific insights into what it's like to live a different kind of life that you don't have and can't access. That's true, but that's generally not the kind of case that I'm talking about in suggesting that parents ought to have the option of euthanasia in cases of severe disabilities. Is there any way in which airing your more controversial philosophical views has been detrimental to your larger project? This is the idea that people might be turned off by what Peter Singer has to say about people with disabilities, and therefore they're not going to pay attention to what he has to say about animal rights. There is a possible trade-off, yes, but it's difficult as a philosopher, because I get asked these questions, and if I start to prevaricate or be fuzzy about the answer, my reputation as a philosopher falls. It's important to try to follow the argument wherever it goes. There may be some cost to it, but it's hard to balance those costs against the fact that you're regarded as a rigorous, clear-thinking philosopher, and people pay more attention to what you say for that reason. I read your memoir, Pushing Time Away. 3 of your 4 grandparents died at the hands of the Nazis in the Holocaust, and about your grandfather, David Oppenheim, who was a collaborator of Freud's, you wrote that he spent his life trying to understand his fellow human beings, yet seems to have failed to take the Nazi threat to the Jews seriously enough. Maybe he had too much confidence in human reason. Do you see your grandfather's work and your work as interacting with or paralleling each other in any way? Possibly paralleling, but not really interacting, because I didn't read my grandfather's work until the late 1990s, and I'd already written Animal Liberation. I'd already written Practical Ethics. I'd already written Rethinking Life and Death. What you could point to, I suppose, would be that some of my grandfather's general attitudes were passed down to me by my mother. That would include the fact that I'm not religious. Some of that did get passed down to me, but not in terms of my specific views about suffering. Now, were they influenced by the knowledge of the suffering that the Nazis inflicted on my grandparents and other members of my extended family, and on my parents by driving them out of their home in Vienna? That might have led to why trying to prevent unnecessary suffering has been a leading impulse in the work that I've written. But do you think it did lead to that? I honestly don't know. I don't have the self-awareness to say to what extent was knowledge of the Holocaust background in my family decisive in leading me in that direction. This is a self-awareness question. When your mom was dying from Alzheimer's, it was some form of dementia. I don't know if it was Alzheimer's. You spent a fair amount of money on providing care toward the end of her life, which is obviously completely understandable. But was that the most utilitarian use of your money? And if not, Did that teach you something about the limits of rational thinking when it comes to helping people? It was probably not the most utilitarian thing to do with those resources, but there would have been personal cost to me, both in thinking I hadn't looked after my mother and also I had a sister. If I had said, "You can pay for our mother's care, but I'm not going to," that would have totally disrupted the warm relationship that I had with my sister. Now, you could argue the money could have helped many people in important ways, and therefore I was being, in a sense, self-interested in not wanting to cause that family rupture. That gets to your second question. Does it show there are limits? Yes, I think there are, certainly. I'm aware there are limits to things that I am prepared to do in order to produce the greatest good. Are those limits a version of common sense? I think they're a version of what we can reasonably expect people to do. Maybe it's not good to ask people to do more than we can reasonably expect them to do. There's a distinction between what would be the right thing to do to the extent that we act in a perfectly ethical way, and what is the right thing to ask others to do, perhaps even to do yourself, that might take more account of the fact that we are not perfectly rational, perfectly ethical beings. One of the things I find myself struggling with about your ideas relates to what the philosopher Derek Parfit calls the repugnant conclusion. If you follow some of your ideas through to their logical conclusions, you can wind up in morally disturbing places. An example would be, tell me if I'm wrong, that according to your thinking, a large number of people with lives barely worth living could be considered better than a smaller number of people living great lives. Your response to that is what? That it's unlikely we'd ever follow these ideas through to their logical conclusions? My response on that particular case is that that's not my clear view. I'm still somewhat open-minded on that issue. But maybe you're asking a broader question about whether I hold views that leave me uncomfortable in some way. And yes, there are views that I hold that leave me quite uncomfortable. Like what? Views about distribution of well-being. Suppose that you have the choice of helping people who are very badly off by a small amount, or helping people who are reasonably well off by a much larger amount, and you can't do both. You can imagine cases where you spend a vast amount of resources making a small number of people who are really bad off slightly better off, or you make, let's say, 95% of the population significantly better off. I think the right thing to do is to make 95% of the population significantly better off. But I'm uncomfortable about the thought that there are people who are worse off, and you could help them, but you don't. I am sorry to report that this is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.